This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Republican National Convention wrapped up last week in Cleveland. The Democrats are holding theirs in Philadelphia this week. Polls are showing a tightening race for president, and we're going to discuss where the race stands in Michigan and nationally with Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wielhauer. Thank you both for being here.
Always a pleasure.
So let's start, first of all, by talking about Michigan and Hillary Clinton, who seemingly has quite an advantage in terms of organization and money. Does that tell us that right now Donald Trump would have a fight to compete in Michigan, as he says he's going to do?
Yeah, I think that any time that you've got the kind of organization that the Democratic Party generally has built up across the nation, and especially in relatively blue states like Michigan, when you have a Republican trying to compete with that, he or she will definitely be at a disadvantage. And so I think Hillary does have an advantage here in terms of the structure in place.
Another aspect of that advantage is that oftentimes we look to the governor of a state to provide support and leadership within that state in a presidential election campaign. Rick Snyder's kind of damaged goods right now. He's not in a very good position to lead. And as a result, that generally speaking, we would think would hurt the Republican effort as well.
I agree with that. And that gubernatorial dimension is exacerbated by the fact that Rick Snyder's kind of keeping Donald Trump at arm's length. He's not really getting behind him.
Yeah. On the other hand, as we've seen throughout this entire election season, Donald Trump plays by a different set of rules.
Right.
And whether or not the disadvantage in terms of organization and money and everything else, campaign infrastructure, that may or may not make a difference for somebody that can seemingly dominate the news simply by, you know, opening up his phone and tweeting off a message of some sort.
I think this will be an interesting campaign of contrasts because the Clinton campaign nationwide is simply running a really, really conventional campaign, setting things up the way that all the experts say you have to set up a campaign in order to win in terms of organization, location, ad purchasing, ad placement, and so forth. And Donald Trump, as we've seen for the last several months, is just really playing by a different set of rules.
Could we end up finding out, however, that those different set of rules work really well in a Republican primary and that by the time you get to a general election, that the old model still has some staying power? In other words, maybe this is like playing two different golf courses. You need a different set of clubs for one than you do for another.
Well, what I emphasized in my graduate class in elections this past spring, and I'll emphasize it again in my undergraduate class in elections this fall, is that the rules matter. If you don't understand how the rules work, including ballot access laws, including how the two-party system is set up, that you are at a disadvantage. And so I think here the Democrats really do have a big advantage. And it does seem that even Donald Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, seems to have not really that great a grasp of how campaigns ought to be structured and set up and move forward.
They brought in Manafort because he was a convention expert.
Exactly.
And that We can argue about the nuances of the convention, which Trump said was the greatest convention of all time, and so far, no one not affiliated with the Trump campaign seems to be saying that. But by bringing somebody in who understood delegate selection, understood those kinds of issues, they kind of righted the ship at a time when things didn't look so good for them. It may be that now that we're past the convention, that they bring on some people that understand how general election campaigns traditionally have worked. Whether or not they go all in with that kind of model is certainly an open question. But it might bring some stability to the campaign and provide some infrastructure that would be beneficial nationally in terms of the more traditional aspects of campaigning that we're used to seeing.
If they bring in that staff, that would make a difference, but the clock is really ticking. They don't have an awful lot of time left to try to restructure the organization of the campaign.
That's right.
So, John, you mentioned that Donald Trump said it was the greatest Republican convention in the history of the country, and a lot of other people have thrown some cold water on that, but you also have to say that they have apparently gotten a bounce in the polls, and that Donald Trump is doing better in the most recent surveys nationally than he was before the convention. But one thing I want to ask about here is how much should we take polls seriously right now, especially when we're between conventions and the Democrats have not had their 4 days yet?
Well, we shouldn't take those polls too seriously yet, except that we need to think a little bit about what it is that conventions do and where that convention bounce comes from. And, you know, the main thing, I think, is that the convention kicks off the general election campaign. Now, it used to be that, I mean, this structure is one that goes back to the 1830s. It's a tradition in American politics that has evolved over time. But the one thing that it does, the function that it performs, in addition to the tasks of, you know, formally nominating president and vice president, is to kick off the general election campaign. If you watch the convention, I'm not sure it did a very good job of that if you watched the whole convention. But the two things that it did do in a very herky-jerky, disconnected way was to both define who Donald Trump is, primarily through the speeches that his kids gave that were about him and were really almost the only speeches that were about him, but were heartfelt and presented him as someone with a heart, and to define Hillary Clinton as somebody that can't be trusted, somebody that should be locked up. And in that sense, you know, maybe if you watch the convention, you would have thought, oh, my gosh, this is a mess. But maybe those two messages, to the extent that they've permeated the media and subsequently the conscience of the electorate, maybe they did do a good job of sort of setting up the general election campaign in a way that will be beneficial, not just right after the convention, but as we move forward.
I think that the convention did a pretty good job in terms of developing those two dimensions, I think, of Donald Trump. One, as you said, is making him seem more like a person by having his kids talk. I think that was very, very important for them to accomplish. But I also think that his own speech helped to clarify for a lot of people who he is from a political standpoint, what his leadership style would be like, because I think most people's impressions who haven't been paying attention to this for months is really based on his reality TV and his celebrity status. But his speech, you know, from the independents and the Republicans' perspective, really helped to solidify some things. I disagree about the idea that it made much of a difference in terms of perceptions of Hillary Clinton. I think that people's understanding of who she is, or at least their concept of who she is pretty well fixed now because she's been on the political landscape so long. I'm not sure there was much that could be done to change people's perceptions at the Republican convention. And I actually am skeptical about whether the Democrats can do much to change people's perceptions.
Just because she's been around so long.
Because she's a known quantity, maybe more than anybody else in American politics today. So it will be interesting to see if people's perceptions of her change at all in the polling following this convention.
I think it's going to be much more difficult for the Democrats and the Democratic convention to change perceptions of her. I think where the Republican convention was effective was in reinforcing this narrative that we've heard for a long time about Hillary Clinton, that she simply can't be trusted. She's narcissistic. I mean, all these things, all these negatives about her that have been at least a part of her public image from the get-go, from when she was first introduced to us in national politics in, 1991. And that message was reinforced during the Republican convention. It'll be difficult for the Democrats to counter that narrative because they're trying to present a different message. Now, Democrats like her, and, you know, they're not buying it. But this is not going to be an election that is won with independent voters because there aren't that many of them to begin with, and this campaign is not going to be about driving them to the polls. It's going to be driving them away from the polls. And so if the Republicans can hold their base, the Democrats can hold their base, the Republicans, the Trump folks at least, think that that's going to be the winning strategy. And I think that was the reason in part for what we saw at the convention, if in fact that was the goal, if in fact that was strategic.
And I think that there are two interesting groups that we really need to be watching carefully. One is the Never Trump movement. To what extent are they actually going to stay Never Trump voters when it comes time to the fall? And what about the Never Hillary voters who are kind of Bernie Sanders stalwarts?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, what percentage of the Democratic base are they? What percentage of the Republican base are the Never Trump people? And where do they live and where do they vote? Are they in
what do they do in
states?
November? Do they?
And
what states? Right?
It doesn't matter what they do in New York. It doesn't matter what they do in Texas. It matters what they do in Ohio and Florida and Virginia and even Michigan,
and probably Michigan. So you noted earlier that Governor Snyder has sort of kept Donald Trump at arm's length. That's true of a lot of Republicans in Michigan, a lot of Republican elected officials. Congressman Fred Upton has said he's not endorsing anyone. Don't look for an endorsement before the November general election. There's some other Republicans who are being rather cautious in what they say about Donald Trump. And I'm wondering, I guess, first of all, what might that mean? If Donald Trump is serious about trying to win Michigan, he says he is, but of course you always have to say that. And if you think your trade stance might help you, could it hurt and take away your chances if you have Republicans in the state who are, you know, relatively popular saying, I don't know about Donald Trump?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how those folks behave during the campaign itself. If the Trump campaign makes a stop in Kalamazoo, say, does Fred Upton show up if he's in town, or does he not? Now, he could be in Washington. I mean, that's
if his schedule permits.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, what does he have to do to book something that keeps him from
that
event?
Does he have to mow his lawn that weekend? Yeah. Those kind of
but it also isn't clear with this candidate and with this campaign whether that really is going to make much of a difference. I mean, it doesn't matter whether somebody that's truly an establishment Republican, doesn't matter if a Fred Upton says, yes, this is my guy. I'm not sure that it does necessarily.
Well, look, every 4 years we have this discussion about which candidates are being seen with the presidential candidates and which candidates aren't being seen with the presidential candidates. So the question is, because Donald Trump is so much more polarizing than other candidates, will that make a difference? It will be a different dynamic this year. I tend to approach these questions with what is the risk to the candidate of being connected to Donald Trump versus what's the reward? For a candidate like Fred Upton, it's pretty high risk. He's a moderate Republican, moderate center-right Republican, and I know people will disagree with that, but yeah, objectively speaking, that's where he is. And so to what extent is he going to gain any votes by aligning himself with Trump? He has a much higher risk of losing votes from the center part of his coalition by aligning with Trump. And so it makes more sense for him to be agnostic about it, whereas other candidates who are more conservative, it's going to help them.
And that's, of course, the other question Republicans are asking themselves. What does a Donald Trump candidacy mean for other races down the ballot? And Pete, I think what I'm hearing from you on that question is it might depend on the race, where they are, what district they're in, what sort of candidate this person was from the get-go.
I agree with that. And I agree with myself, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, but I think that you've understood me correctly. I think that the candidates are going to look at this candidate, this presidential candidate, and they're going to evaluate, what am I going to get out of this? What are the risks that I run? I think that relatively unknown candidates, they might actually be more likely on the conservative side, the Republican side, might be more likely to connect themselves to Trump because of the name recognition. Being able to be seen with Trump, that's going to be, as Donald Trump puts it, any publicity is good publicity. And so that might help them in terms of helping unknown candidates. Established candidates, people that have been in the public eye for a while, you know, then you'll have to look at kind of more specifically about their voter coalitions, what's at stake for them individually.
I agree with yourself, too.
Excellent.
Some Michigan Republicans are talking about the fact that Mike Pence is on the ticket, the governor of Indiana, as a sign that Donald Trump really wants to make a play in the Midwest. Is there any historical evidence of a running mate who has been able to generate any reach beyond their own state? Lyndon Johnson, it's argued, helped John Kennedy carry Texas in 1960. But we're talking Indiana. If Donald Trump is fighting for Indiana, he's in real trouble. That's a state Republicans usually win. But is there any evidence that the governor of Indiana, for instance, can influence voters in Ohio or maybe Michigan?
Well, I don't think Mike Pence is especially well known in states other than Indiana. But what he does bring to the ticket is representation for a certain wing of the Republican Party that's not otherwise represented by the Trump candidacy. He's a social conservative. He has government experience, both as governor and before that as a member of Congress. To the extent that he helps, it's more of an indirect effect in the sense that this is an example of how Donald Trump, sort of a loose cannon, can reach out to somebody who is not that way and bring them into his coalition. And other people might say, oh, well, if somebody like, you know, not if Pence, because they don't know Pence, but if somebody like Pence can get on board with this campaign, then maybe there's something there that we didn't see the first time, or maybe there are some things that we were a little bit worried about that we don't have to be as worried about. I think it's more that indirect effect that we would expect to see coming out of any vice presidential choice, whether it's Pence on the Republican side or
Tim Kaine on the
Democratic side.
Yeah. I think that's right. And Donald Trump, because historically he has not been a social conservative, I think it was important for him to find somebody as a running mate who could beef up his social conservative bona fides. And so I think that Pence did that. I think that John's right on that.
Democrats have won Michigan's electoral votes now in every election going back to 1992. There were two pretty close races in there, however, 2000 and 2004. And both years, there were high-profile ballot issues. There was a school voucher question in 2000 that many Republicans believe helped Al Gore win the state that year. And then there was the gay marriage ban in 2004 that passed overwhelmingly. And that may have helped George W. Bush get within about 160,000 votes of John Kerry that year. Kerry was still able to win Michigan's electoral votes. Right now, as we sit here and talk, there doesn't seem like there will be really anything of consequence on the ballot this year. Certainly no amendments, proposed amendments to the state constitution. Does that influence the race in any way or alter the question in any way of what will ultimately happen with the presidential race?
My sense with this race is that even if there were significant things on the ballot, there's really not going to be a lot of oxygen for those campaigns to sort of have an impact on most voters and their decision making. What we've seen so far is, particularly on the Trump side, a candidate who can simply dominate the news cycle in almost every conceivable way. And yep. I think that's going to really make it difficult for other candidates in close races who are trying to define themselves and define their opponents to have much of an impact. That, to some extent, gets to the point that Pete made before about the significance of aligning oneself with Trump or not for Republican candidates down ticket, because of the fact that there may not be any other way to kind of define yourself to your voters, to your electorate. And if there were something significant on the ballot, might that change the dynamic? It certainly could. But it also seems as though with the amount of money that we're going to see, with the amount of advertising that we're going to see, if Michigan is in any way competitive, it's just difficult to imagine how most voters would react to those kinds of ballot situations.
I think it's worth pointing out that in the last several presidential elections, Republicans in the middle of the summer after the conventions have all said, yes, Michigan's in play for us. Yeah. And yet by late August, early September, there's pretty much nothing to be heard from them. The other thing that
even from Mitt Romney, who was born in Michigan, really, you didn't hear from him from about August on in terms of Michigan.
Because strategically, it didn't make sense for them to continue to pour resources into the state. One thing that will impact our election results in a different way that is related to the ballot is the change in the straight ticket ballot ruling from the Republican side. So the Republicans supported this, doing away with the straight ticket ballot. A federal judge nullified that, and so now we're going to have the straight ticket ballot, it looks like.
Yeah, there's still an appeal process, but they would have to be done awfully quick.
It had to be done quickly, right. So let's say right now we have that straight ballot access so that when somebody votes Democrat, that votes Democratic for all the Democratic candidates going down the ticket. Same thing for the Republicans, though. And it may be that for those down ballot Republicans, Trump's candidacy might actually be an advantage. If you have independents, if you have swing voters who end up casting a vote for Donald Trump, but who are kind of apathetic about the rest of the ballot, it may be that they see this as a moment when they just might say, take the easy way. And the Republican side would have more of an advantage than we've seen in the past from the straight ticket ballot. That would be an interesting outcome. It's hard to know whether that would occur, but because Trump's supporters are largely on the lower level of the education, lower level of the economic system, I think that is a possibility because those are the folks most likely to vote straight ticket.
John Clark, we've got about a minute, so if you want to respond to that before we wrap up.
I think the one challenge will be, and this gets back to resources and everything else for campaigns, whether or not Trump is seen as a Republican or whether he's seen as Trump. Yeah. And to the extent to which he is not a part of the Republican establishment, not a part of the Republican tradition, I think that becomes more of a challenge for him to activate people to vote straight ticket.
I agree.
All right. Well, we will have plenty to talk about between now and November, but thank you both, as always, for an interesting discussion about the state of the race for now.
Always a pleasure.
It's been fun.
Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wheelhauer joining us. This is WMUK's West Southwest. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Enbridge Energy will pay $177 million as part of a settlement which was announced by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Justice Department. The company is paying in part for violations of the Clean Water Act related to pipeline ruptures, including one that led to the massive oil spill on the Kalamazoo River in 2010. But environmental groups are saying that the settlement doesn't go far enough. Josh Mogerman is National Media Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So when this was announced, the Department of Justice said it was the largest civil penalty for an oil spill in U.S. history. Is that significant?
Well, it is significant, but this is also the largest inland oil spill in American history, so it's appropriate. That said, you know, when you break it, you buy it. And we feel like you can't help but think that maybe Enbridge got away getting a sale price on this. The fines are significant, but they are not so huge that they're likely to change the way the pipeline industry looks at spills as just another cost of business.
What do you think are the factors that someone should consider here when they're trying to come up with an amount? How do you sort of put all the various factors together? What are those factors you think that someone should be considering at the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Justice?
Well, I think there are a lot of things within the statute that point them in certain directions, but the fines that we saw certainly aren't going to do what needs to happen to make the communities along Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River whole. A lot of money has been spent to clean up that river, but that river is broken. The oil is always going to be in that river. And if you talk to folks who live in those communities, the health impacts, the economic impacts, and just the quality of life impacts that they suffered through really aren't addressed in these fines. And that's where I think we fall short.
Do you think that it is appropriate that this money is supposed to go to improving pipelines?
Well, it's certainly where Enbridge would like for things to go, and that certainly seems to be the motivation for most everything, including increasing the capacity of the pipelines that they have in the state of Michigan rather than replacing the existing ones. Certainly, there are some issues that need to be addressed there. We think that the making the communities along the waterways whole should be the priority and something that is a focus, and we think that that simply isn't happening here.
So would you like to see then more of the money dedicated to that, going to the people who live along the Kalamazoo River, whose lives were impacted by that oil spill in 2010?
Well, absolutely. We feel that there needs to be continued attention to those communities, to addressing those impacts, and less attention to pipeline infrastructure and helping out things that ultimately are useful to Enbridge's bottom line.
Couldn't it also be argued, however, that it's also beneficial to improve pipeline safety to prevent the next Kalamazoo River-like oil spill down the road?
Well, absolutely. But the fact of the matter is that is the cost of doing business for Enbridge. That is what they are supposed to be investing in. That's their business. That is not the taxpayers' business. And the fact of the matter is this pipeline spill happened because they weren't keeping their eye on their business. They were aware of hundreds of defects on this line that they chose not to address until the seemingly inevitable spill occurred. We think that the communities that were impacted by Enbridge's inaction or inability to maintain their pipeline system are far more important, and that the costs should be borne by the people that are profiting from it.
Josh, do you have a price tag? Do you have a number in your head, or does anyone at the NRDC have a number that they've come up with where you would have said, okay, that was an appropriate fine?
I don't, but I think there was an interesting point made by Nick Schreck in the Detroit Free Press in their coverage of this earlier in the week, where he talked about this as sort of a middle course, where it is more than the bare minimum, but didn't strike him, I'm paraphrasing, but it didn't feel like retribution. This was, he felt, a comfortable middle spot. And we feel that this is an industry that has had a lot of problems in the last few years. The Kalamazoo spill was the first of many. And this is an industry that is looking to expand all over the continent. And so it's very important to send a message in these cases. And we just don't feel that that was done in this case.
And can you explain to listeners who Nick Schreck is who don't know?
Oh, I'm sorry. Nick is a law professor at Wayne State in Detroit and is, I think, a respected legal mind in the state.
So when this was announced, the federal officials who put forth this settlement said that they thought it was a strong deterrent and would hold Enbridge accountable. But what message do you think has been sent to Enbridge or other companies that own pipelines?
I think the message that's being sent is, well, you should be paying attention to the safety of your pipelines. But if you have a problem, even if it happens to be a problem of historic stature, the fines are going to be manageable. This is a small fraction of what Enbridge raked in just the last couple of quarters, and that doesn't send the message that needs to be sent.
I couldn't help but notice when the announcement was made that the NRDC and other groups were pretty quick to put out statements saying that this was not enough of a fine. Were you watching this closely because it was the largest inland oil spill in the history of the United States, and that you were viewing this as the precedent that was going to be set for future oil spills, if they happen?
Well, the short answer to that is yes, absolutely. The longer answer is the Kalamazoo spill was a really important moment that made people aware of some fundamental shifts that have been occurring in our energy sector, and particularly in the oil sector. The shift to this heavier, more difficult form of oil coming from Canada, bitumen, diluted bitumen, tar sands oil. But many of the problems that we saw in the cleanup and in the spill itself were as a result of ignorance of this particular kind of oil. There was a lot of attention paid in the cleanup to skimming the surface, and most of the damage was going on underneath the surface at the river bottom. That's something that I think the EPA has been pretty open about. This particular form of oil is one that is proliferating in the United States, and particularly here in the upper Midwest, where we're kind of at the epicenter of the industry. And there is a very aggressive effort underway from particularly the pipeline industry to move this stuff into further and further into the United States and to get it exported into the world market. I think what you see from environmental groups is real concern about the potential impact that comes from that proliferation and real concern that it's not something that is being taken seriously. The signal that would come from these fines would be an important signal to the industry that they need to be thinking about this stuff differently, that they need to conduct the appropriate studies to understand how and if this particular kind of oil can be moved safely. And that just doesn't seem to be happening right now. We're seeing projects that seem to be rubber stamped. And when those projects go wrong, we need people to be held more heavily accountable.
Josh Mogerman, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Josh Mogerman is National Media Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.